Welcome to the weekend edition of the Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. On today's program, we got a lot to cover, as always, and looking forward to introducing you to today's guests. But in addition to that, I do want to mention that the Price of Business, which is one of the longest-running business shows in the country, continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com. We are adding new content all the time. There you can see all of our regular guests. We have reoccurring guests from Fox Business, from Yahoo Finance, gentlemen like Cody Willard, who was a longtime CNBC and Fox Business anchor. He's on this program every single week. And so we're excited by the talent that we bring you. Also, I do want to mention I've got a book called Making New Rich Books Work for You, and exclusively for our listeners of this program. It's available at a ridiculously low price. If you want to get more information about that, go to priceofbusiness.com. If you read anything by people like Tim Ferriss or Robert Kiyosaki, who's been on my show many, many times, and you know, really were excited but had little to show for it when you try to pursue those things, my book explains why. There's something going on, and the problem really isn't with these authors. It's usually with the reader. And you can get more information about that at priceofbusiness.com. With that, here's our first guest right here on The Price of Business.
Hello, and welcome to the Next Level series on the Price of Business Radio Network. I'm Daphne Michaels, human potential expert and ultra consciousness leadership guide. Let's explore what it means to unlock human potential in corporate environments. This is not just a strategy, it's a necessity for thriving in today's dynamic business landscape. As someone who has dedicated my life to helping individuals and organizations elevate their potential, I've seen firsthand how transformative it can be when leaders embrace a higher level of awareness. One of the most powerful strategies is fostering energetic awareness. By understanding the vibrations and frequencies that influence our thoughts, emotions, and interactions, leaders can create environments where individuals feel empowered to contribute their best. Everything in life, our bodies, environments, and relationships, operates on a certain frequency. High vibrations are associated with positive emotions like joy, clarity, and creativity, while low vibrations stem from stress, fear, or negativity. When leaders tune into these energetic states, they can consciously shift their teams toward higher, more empowering vibrations. This shift not only enhances personal well-being, but also creates a ripple effect, positively influencing the entire organization. Another critical approach is elevating consciousness. I've long advocated for practices that help individuals see beyond immediate challenges, enabling them to align their personal growth with organizational goals. When leaders guide their teams to embrace a mindset of abundance over scarcity, they unlock creativity and innovation in ways that transform the workplace. Finally, community and connection are essential. Through my work with ultra-conscious leadership, I've witnessed the power of supportive networks in driving transformation. In corporate settings, this translates to building teams that thrive on trust, shared purpose, and mutual growth. By integrating these principles, energetic awareness, elevated consciousness, and meaningful connection, business leaders can nurture a workforce that is not only productive, but also deeply fulfilled. This is how we unlock the extraordinary potential that lies within every individual and create organizations that thrive in every sense of the word. Until next time on The Next Level, remember, transformation begins with conscious choices. Be bold, be intentional, and embrace your capacity to shape the future of your organization with confidence. For more information about ultra-conscious leadership, visit my website at daphnemichaels.com.
I'm Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business program. Marianne Fairmouth, she's a regular on the Price of Business Media Network, and we love having her on the program each week, bringing her insight, particularly from her book that I consider revolutionary when it comes to recruiting. You can learn more about Marianne over at Fairmouth, that's F-A-R-E-M-O-U-T-H.com.
Sometimes You just need to talk to other writers because writing is a different type of profession or hobby. If you do it as a hobby, that's fine. But it's a different type of animal than a lot of other things. And sometimes you just need to talk to someone who understands.
There are opportunities for our work and careers everywhere, if you know where to look. That's easier said than done, especially in our fast-paced and constantly changing world. Marianne Fairmouth is talking to experts, employers, and job seekers to bring you insight and understanding about what's possible. This is Career Can Do, where we're navigating the new work world.
Welcome to the Career Can Do podcast. We're happy to have Alicia Richardson here today. She's the CFO of the Houston Writers Guild, and I've been a part of this organization for many, many years, and it's a wonderful organization, helps so many people, and we've got a big conference coming up in just a couple of weeks, and so I wanted to have Alicia on the show today to talk to our listeners about what it's all about. So, Alicia, you've been a member for a long time. Tell us what the mission of the Houston Writers Guild is and how it's evolved over the years.
All right, our mission, Roger Paulding started the guild many years ago, and he organized like a lot of groups, and they had an annual contest, manuscript contest every year. And over time, our focus has shifted a little bit as we've had CEOs with different visions. But the main thing is we organize events and gather resources to help writers hone their skills. So like critique groups and the conferences. And down in this corner over my shoulder, we do a joint venture with WIVLA. That's the Women in Literary and Visual Arts. So we have a short story contest, and then we pick the top three, first, second, and third, and then honorable mentions to make an anthology. So that's usually run in conjunction with our conference.
Okay. Well, you know, Alicia, I'm obviously a recruiter in addition to being an author and a writer. But as a recruiter, I really think the skills of writing are extremely important. The better writer you are, the better you can communicate on your job. So I think this conference is a wonderful one. And I think it can help so many people. With that in mind, Alicia, who can join the guild and what kind of people do you typically support?
Okay, so we are open to anyone. Some organizations, you have to have sold a certain number of publications in order to qualify to join, but we welcome anybody. We've got critique groups that support writers of all ability levels. I mean, you can be a beginner and join a critique group. And so when we put the conferences together, we try to include speakers who can address like business, craft, and inspiration so that there's something for everybody.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, you know, I started writing because I had a lot of challenges at a certain point in my life. In a 3-year period, I lost 5 people. And my good friend from Michigan, who was a journalist, said to me, you know, why don't you take a writing for healing class? So I sat down on my computer one day and I typed in writing for healing, and it was a Saturday. And the next day there was a class at the Spectrum Center with Max Reagan. And I took that class, and that was the beginning of the end. I started to write after that. But I think writing has a lot of applications in many ways. And I think right now, Alicia, with all the challenges we have in the world, I think people that, you know, maybe are going through a tough time, if they thought about writing and getting things out, sometimes that does help. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, journaling benefits a lot of people. I've done journaling and it helps.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we touched upon this already. But, you know, what makes the Houston Writers Guild unique compared with some other writing organizations is that you don't have to be a published author to be a member, and a lot of other
organizations. That's one thing, because a lot of the groups target specific either genres or types of writers, like the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. They have a magnificent chapter here in Houston. If you write children's books, I would highly recommend you connect with them. But they only focus on children's books, and we have a broad umbrella, and we have authors that write pretty much everything. So,
you know, I've attended this for many, many years, and the speakers that you have, the different seminars you offer are so helpful to so many kinds of people. That's why I wanted to have you all on the show, because I think it's an organization that really gives a lot of good information, and the people that you have as speakers are really interesting and helpful. So how would you say that the Guild fosters creative growth and collaboration among its members?
Okay, so one of the things that we do is we offer critique groups. And for any of your listeners who are not familiar with critique groups, you have a group of people. We found that like 6 to 7 is probably the optimum number, but you need at least 3. But you get together and you share your work and other people make comments on it. And one of the ways that helps is a lot of times you have stuff in your head and you know that about the story or the character, but the reader doesn't because it's in your head. And they can point that out to you, help you get that out down on the paper to make your work better. We also do the conferences. Historically, we have done 2 conferences, one in the spring that is primarily focused on traditionally published authors with agents and editors. We weren't able to do that this year. And then we do one in the fall that's Indiepalooza that focuses on independently published authors. So we try to have a balance of stuff for, you know, traditionally and independently published people. We also have an event, it's called Social Saturday, and it's a Zoom call at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. And if you go to our website, that's HoustonWritersGuild.org, there's a link to it. So if anyone who wants to join us at 10 a.m. on Saturday will be there. Obviously, the weekend of the 27th, we won't be there because I'll be at the conference, but I host that. And then we have a luncheon once a month. We call it the Social Saturday Lunch Bunch. So you can come and talk to other writers in an informal setting, because sometimes you just need to talk to other writers, because writing is a different type of profession or hobby. If you do it as a hobby, that's fine. But it's a different type of animal than a lot of other things. And sometimes you just need to talk to someone who understands.
Oh, I think you're right. You know, it's funny. I was in a class one time, and I was a writing class, and I think the Houston Writers Guild sponsored it. And one of your board members was in the class, and I had written this short story, and she read it over, and it was a critique group. And she said, you know, Marianne, I think if you changed it around this and had the plot a little different and this and that. So I did what she told me, and I did enter a contest, and it won first place. So I think those critiques can really help, you know, and you've got so many experienced writers in the Houston Writers Guild. So can you yourself share a success story from the Guild? Somebody, a Guild member whose career was positively impacted by the organization?
Well, there's several people in our Thursday critique group that have gone on and had some publishing success. One of our members is Tassie Callis, and she writes humorous women's fiction, think Irma Bombeck, that type of stuff. And when she started with our group, she was a brand new newbie writer. She hadn't been writing a whole lot, but she's been in our critique group for years now, and she's had stuff published in Chicken Soup for the Soul. She's got a collection of short stories called Yaya's Big Black Purse. She's been in the last 3 of our joint venture anthologies with WIVLA. She's been at least an honorable mention in all 3 of those. So she's had 3 different stories in the Journey Into anthologies. And I think she's had some magazine publications as well. So being in the critique group, I think, and she's also done some like Irma Bombeck writing conferences. So I mean, we can't take all the credit, but I think, you know, being in a critique group kind of forces accountability, because it's like, you have to have your pages. Okay. We're not going to kick somebody out if they don't bring pages every single week, because we meet weekly, but it's like, oh, I've got to get pages for my critique group on Thursday. So it kind of encourages you to get your stuff done and get your pages submitted so you can get your publication goals met.
That's wonderful. Well, as I said, I certainly been involved in many of the other different conferences you've had. And this one, Melisha, when does it start? When does it end? It's for 2 days or 3 days, or how does it work?
Normally, we have had the book launch event for the anthology on the Friday night. And last year we did it at Brazos Bookstore, and that was really successful. So we're also doing it at Brazos Bookstore this weekend. We'd originally scheduled the conference for the first weekend in October. So that Friday would have been October the 3rd, but there was an issue with the venue. It wasn't available. So we had to move the conference back a week, but yeah, it'll be there at Rice University. And
is that the 27th?
The 27th, yeah, 27th to 28th. 27th is the main day where we have the majority of the speakers. And then Sunday is a half-day workshop with our keynote speaker, Wolf Moon. And that's something that I'm excited to see, because this workshop is one that's in pretty high demand. And normally, if he's just doing the workshop, because he's in the Pacific Northwest, and if he's either traveling somewhere or there locally, the workshop is $100. So a significant discount, and he's doing that to help us out. So if you get a chance to attend on Sunday.
What does he write about?
He writes kind of a little bit of everything. I think he's primarily fantasy and science fiction, but he's got romances, and I think he's got some nonfiction because he, you know, writes some how to write books. But yeah, he writes a lot.
Well, that's great. So if somebody is brand new to the conference and they want to attend, what can they expect? I mean, what is it like? What is the, I know you mentioned the Sunday, but what is it? What can they expect? What kind of different seminars or classes can they take, and what can they expect from it?
So our scheduled speakers that we have, and it's always subject to change because sometimes people come in and some people drop out, but get the keynote on Saturday, and then he's got to roll up your sleeves and actually do some workshop on Sunday. Our speaker last year was Deborah Mouton, and her husband Joshua is going to give a talk on how to build your author website. So whatever level of writing you are, that is information you need to have. And Stacey Eskelin has been publishing for many, many years. She's primarily romance writer, but she's going to talk about handling rejection, because rejection is a fact of life in publishing. So that will help you either build a thick skin or thicken the skin you already have. Mike Coas is going to talk about business and taxes, because if you've sold something, you're going to get a 1099, or, you know, if you have an LLC, or, you know, however your business is set up, you're going to have to pay taxes. So he can give some tips. And the tax rules are always changing. So he'll do some writer-specific tax things. And Daphne Jack is going to talk about writing nonfiction. And she's a really interesting person. She used to be a parole officer, and her husband was convicted for a crime that he did not commit. So she spent years trying to get the situation rectified and get him out of jail and get the person who did commit the crime in jail. And as a result of that, she's founded charities. She's got one for children whose parents are incarcerated to get them school supplies and books and stuff. And she's just an amazing person. So she often drops in on our Saturday morning Zoom call, but I really, really like her. She's doing some professoring. She's working at Houston, I guess it's Houston City College now. She's teaching a class there, and she's also teaching as an online adjunct at Stephen F. Austin. She's a great speaker, and she's just a phenomenal person.
All right. Well, you've got some wonderful, wonderful speakers that are going to be there, and I think this conference can support not only published authors, but people that maybe that are thinking about writing, and to know, you know, what you need on a website, what you, you know, if you're thinking of writing nonfiction or fiction. You know, my forte is mainly nonfiction, but I have written like 7 short story fiction pieces that have been published. And I am writing a fiction book right now too, as well. So I think the conference opens up so many new ideas for people. And again, as I said, being a career counselor, being a recruiter, I can't stress enough how I hear clients talk about how they're impressed with the way somebody wrote a thank you note, or the way somebody wrote their introduction or their cover letter or their resume. So writing is a skill that really is imperative in the career world. But also, I believe, and writing helps you, as you say, you know, journaling helps you get ideas out. And I think, you know, we all are trying to become our best self. And if we have another skill we can perfect and work through and work with, and there's a conference available to help you do that, I think you all need to check it out. It's a wonderful group. The people I've met in this organization are really neat people. They're smart, they're caring, they're gifted. But check out the Houston Writers Guild. If you get a chance, try to go on September 27th, 28th. It's an amazing event. Alicia, I always like to leave our listeners with 2 salient points at the end. If somebody's listening to this and they're just not sure about whether they'd be a possible contender or person to attend, what would you tell them? What would you say 2 things they'd get out of going to this conference?
I would say push the boat out, because you never know who you're going to meet, and you never know who's going to inspire you. And sometimes just sitting and soaking up the atmosphere can give you the boost that you need to keep going. Because like I said, writing is a lonely, it's something you do by yourself. And sometimes just connecting with other people who are doing the same thing is really, really important to keep that flow going.
Oh, I agree with you so much. And the people I've met through the Houston Writers Guild are just wonderful people. And it's helped me as an individual grow. And I've learned so much. So Alicia, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Career Can Do. I've always admired you and the people on the board. And I look forward to seeing you on September 27th and 28th. So that's the end of this Career Can Do. And we'll see y'all next time. Bye-bye.
We thank you for tuning in to our Career Can Do podcast. We make no guarantees on results for your particular quest, but we hope you enjoy the information presented. The views and opinions expressed in this program are solely that of the guest or speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Marianne Fairmouth and Fairmouth & Company. Thank you.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kev, talking to you about you and your business. Always love chatting with Michael Marino. He's a regular on the program. He is our business attorney with a very specific focus on negotiation. And I was just immediately enamored by his work the first time I had him on the program. I thought, yeah, this is something we need on our program because, frankly, negotiation is one of the many lost arts. He and I were talking about during the break how reading has become a lost art. I read about it. I see about it everywhere. And there's so many things that have been lost. Negotiation is one of them. And I think one of the reasons why is that we've moved from a pliable position of getting things done to one of abstinence and really trying to be right continuously rather than successful. And we're going to focus on success because guess what? Sometimes that means flexibility. And that too is a lost art. Michael, always glad to have you on the program. Just take a minute to talk about your practice and also the best website to learn more about it. And then go right ahead and introduce our topic and welcome, as always.
Kevin, thank you for that, and good morning again. Always a pleasure and a privilege to be here. So, as you mentioned, primarily what I focus on ranges kind of under the rubric today of crisis management, collective bargaining, litigation, negotiation, really trying to solve problems that we have to find both a practical way and a way of defining what is success. And as you mentioned, you know, in my firm, SafeArth, we're one of those global law firms, 1,000 lawyers, SafeArth.com, and lots of lawyers involved in these kinds of complex issues every day, trying to do, again, what's in the best interest of the client. And I think it dovetails right into the discussions you and I have been having about the art of negotiation and who is really defining success. And then just a real quick footnote on the reading aspect, I think that, yes, I watched a segment. I saw the Harvard Education dean talking about in the last 50 years, the numbers are staggering. Adults and children down 60-70% of what people were reading several decades ago. So that plays into some, I think, of the understanding of why what it appears to be is not always so when you switch to the generational reading, which is social media. Okay, with that, here we go.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about, I saw this story. You and I correspond quite a bit between segments because, frankly, you tap into something I'm very interested in, you know, which is the nuance, negotiation, win-win, concepts that seem very foreign all of a sudden, and saw a great story on Columbia University providing a juxtaposition to Harvard University's tactics in dealing with the government and really the crackdown you know, by the government and in terms of, you know, getting a situation that works. By the way, my comments are not at all critical of Harvard, and I give them props for their courage in taking the tack that they took. although their problems continue. So, and it looks like Columbia, which took a much more nuanced and savvy approach, provides some pretty interesting education for people.
Absolutely. And I'll, of course, give at the outset my lawyer's caveat. I wasn't involved in Harvard or Columbia, and the for both, as you say, fantastic institutions and historical organizations of knowledge and expertise. And but they did take different paths. And I think what we're doing is kind of extracting the process, and not whether it's, quote, right or wrong. It's how that individual defined success. And I find it fascinating, if you look at the New York Times article, you know, several great quotes from Ms. Shipman, the president. And here's one I think that really sets the framework for what you're talking about. She said, look, as a former journalist, I gravitate towards these themes, the themes that are in the public dialogue. But I guess we all know that real life situations are deeply complex. And I would argue that protecting our principles slowly and carefully while we stabilize the institution requires courage too, and is far from capitulation. And I think that that's how they, at this institution, with all the variables and all the different forces and all the different voices, that's how there was this reconciliation of how to develop a go-forward strategy in a situation that, whatever the outcome, there's going to be differing views.
Yeah, no question about it. And also in Columbia's defense, all of the Ivy League schools, I'm pretty sure, have deep pockets, some more so than others, none as much as Harvard. I mean, Harvard's money is unbelievable what they have. That gives them the ability to play tougher than, say, a Brown. Well, Brown has really rich people involved in it. But say, even Columbia, or certainly Dartmouth. And so that's all part of a larger strategy that smart people put in their calculus, isn't it?
100%. You know, even if we drop down from these high levels, to go back to my farmer's market metaphor, I want those San Marzano tomatoes, and I want them today. I can't wait and get a better price a month from now, because those tomatoes are going to be gone, and I want to enjoy them with that nice burrata in my salad tonight. So you have to decide the objective. And what is success? And I may, at the end, what some people may say, oh, you folded, you paid too much for those tomatoes. Hey, no, I didn't. I got exactly what I knew I wanted, and it allows me to enjoy my dinner this evening. So it really is a matter of perspective, but that's why simplistic, like taking the scorched earth approach or engaging in total capitulation, you know, that's why it's easy, I think, to kind of criticize those. What we're looking for is a word, again, that you've used a lot now in this. Look at the nuances. Look at the edges of what is really going on, and how do we get back to defining success at this moment for this organization or institution?
Yeah. You know, it's one of my favorite words, although these days I sometimes feel like I'm cursing when I use it, but I'm a big fan of it. So let's talk about it. Talk about this negotiation. Why, you know, talk about their objectives and how they smartly, if you will, you know, reach their objectives.
Well, again, many of the real basic things that we have talked about from you obviously have to be prepared. You have to sit down with a blank sheet of paper and determine what those objectives are. And then you have to look at, okay, here's the alternatives. Just like, again, whether it's these schools or whether it's a corporation or whether it's a celebrity or an individual who finds himself in some type of a crisis, they have to define what those objectives are. They have to be really prepared. Then they go through that process of, and again, comes out in the Times article, you have to listen. You can't just knee-jerk jump back and give a response. You got to listen to what the other side says. It doesn't matter, and you're more than likely going to disagree with what they're saying. But if you don't show respect in the process of listening and try to find accommodation. And again, this is headline news everywhere, the global issues, the war issues, everything that is out there. You must try to look at it from the other side of the table in order to be able to find some type of a resolution.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about the steps you saw that was taken by Colombia, and maybe how it differed. I guess complete capitulation, we don't need much comparison with it, because I don't think any have said that, or they would probably, you know, done that, or they would, you know, have a big alumni problem. But let's face it, you know, the Harvard approach was unique. Actually, I think you could say a couple of schools did completely capitulate, actually, the more I think about it. But talk, do a comparison of Colombia and the extremes. And again, not criticizing any of them. All of them have their own constituents. That's another factor. People, I don't think, put a holistic view of these things. There's so many factors. But unfortunately, most people think winning is the only one. And winning, it, therefore, because there's so many different factors, looks different in each case. So talk a little bit about the differences, if you will.
Yeah, I think that again kind of goes right to the heart of the matter, and it applies not just in the university situations, but the two that you're mentioned. And again, the knowledge I have is based only on the public reporting in the Times and other write-ups about it. But the principles I think are the same. It appears on the surface, Harvard is saying, look, this is a fundamental principle, and this happens, of course, in litigation every day. Everybody starts out thinking that there's a principle, and they pound the table, and then they realize, well, we may have a, quote, winning position, but it's not going to be resolved for 4 or 5 or more years. We can't afford that. And afford may not just be financial. It may be the reputation. It may be the kind of hits you're going to take. You mentioned Harvard. They obviously have the resources, and they do have what they considered to be a core principle. So they said, hey, we're in for the fight, and we're going to go forward because this is important. In the reported perspective of Columbia, you have the same factors that are involved, the same principles. They have the same commitment to principles, but they're also looking at, we have ongoing conflicts on the campus. We want to find a solution. What may be considered as a compromise may also be considered a way to navigate that. It's setting us up to go forward to what we do best. We have to address these issues. We acknowledge that we've got some issues to deal with. We're going to get them resolved. We're going to set a framework for going forward and again, do what we do best. You know, you could quickly say that, again, headline news on these issues of the administration and cities and who's going to be responsible for this and that. You know, you have the same type of thing. Some cities are saying, look, we respect your position and we'll accept help. Others are saying, no, that's not within your jurisdiction. I don't know that it's a right or wrong, but it's a way that the client, in this case, whether it's a city, a university, again, a corporation or an individual, they have to decide, how is our organization going to be able to continue to flourish going forward? And all of that has to be resolved.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone likes the armchair quarterback, you know, quarterbacking. I know I do. It's one of my favorite pastimes. I'm pretty sure I would have won many national championships. College football is my favorite if I were a coach. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, you think, if you're honest, being a coach based on what you're seeing on TV, and you think you really would be that good, you're very naive. And if you think you could handle the kind of situations these universities are handling and do it successfully and how easy it would be, you're really naive, like off the chart, like, you know, fairy tale. And this is very difficult stuff. And I again, give props to Harvard, because if some of this is questionable. Some of this deserves a challenge. You know, if they don't challenge, then at some point it never gets its day in court, right? It's through challenging these things that they get their day in court. So props to both for their abilities and their tactics. been dealing with an incredibly difficult situation that time will only tell if it was handled well.
I think, again, I'd revert back to when you, whether it's in the Harvard scenario or, again, in the corporate boardroom, if you hit what you consider a core principle, this is a matter of principle. And because it's a matter of principle, we're going to see it through to its duration. So they went through, obviously, a deliberative process. I'm sure there were lots of voices as to what type of approach to take. But the bottom line is, once they decided that it was into that really basic core principle, and it has to be aired out, regardless of a durational cost, a temporal cost, or a financial cost, that this is something that we need to have an objective, or we hope, third-party kind of resolution. So again, go using process as opposed to, as I say, we're not really making judgments one way or the other. But in terms of process, that one hit the mother nerve with respect to the organization, and therefore they decided, boom, we're not going to compromise on this one.
Love it. Michael Marino, I always love, it's like a master class on negotiation, which is a lost art, and frankly, we need more of, not only in the settings we talk about, you and I talk about in this show, but, you know, how do we work out a deal with our spouse, you know? How do we have, you know, conversations with our best friends about difficult things that need to be addressed? This is applicable to everywhere, and yet we seem extremely capable across the board in all these areas. So it's so huge what we're doing. I love it.
Well, that's why I always go back to the farmer's market, because just as you say,
always make me hungry. Your segments always make me hungry. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, those yeah, we gotta make those same principles apply, just as you said. Every single day, almost every transaction that you're involved in, whether it's friend or foe.
Yep, perfect enough to end on. Give your website one more time, Michael Marino.
It's pretty easy, safe, except for pronouncing seyfarth.com, S-E-Y-F-A-R-T-H. Global law firm, offices around, lots of really talented people.
Yep, very good. Check that out. We, of course, have a link to it at priceofbusiness.com. You are listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. Speaking for more after this.
Welcome to the Igniting Your Dynamic Self show, sponsored by heartsofwellness.com, where strength meets soul. I'm Wendy Bjork, the MS mentor, best-selling author, and wellness guide. I help women navigating multiple sclerosis take charge of their healing journey, mind, body, and spirit, one holistic step at a time. You're not alone, and this is your safe space to rise. Today, we are diving into a topic that resonates deeply with so many of us, how to allow and trust divine timing into our lives despite the challenges of MS or any other chronic. It's about allowing timeless alignment. So grab your journal and a pen. As we move into the closing days of August, the universe offers us a sacred reminder. Everything is happening exactly as it's meant to. For those of us walking with MS and other chronics, this period becomes a portal of trust, surrender, and alignment, layered with the influence of knowing that it's okay to trust your values. The message is clear. Timelessness is real, divine timing is always active, and you are never behind in your journey. This isn't about racing to the finish line or pushing against the current. It's about learning and leaning into faith, embodying patience, and recognizing that the unfolding of your life is orchestrated with a wisdom far beyond human understanding. The invitation is to soften, release control, and embrace the beauty of where you're at right now. Let's explore what this means and how we can harmonize it all into a higher field of empowerment and trust. Timelessness and divine timing. This always carries the energy of faith, truth, and alignment with the higher order. Adding the theme of worth, prosperity, and the way we exchange energy into the world. When we trust ourselves and detach from the outcome, life often presents situations where we might question whether things are on track. Delays, redirections, or unexpected changes may arise, but not to punish us, but to elevate our perspective. Sometimes we hear our inner self or our soul ask, what if everything is already perfect, even when it doesn't look like it? What if you're being guided to see abundance as more than money, success, or speed? This energy reminds us that timing is never wrong. Every so-called detour or pause is actually a refinement, aligning us with the exact right people, opportunities, and insights at the precise moment. Next is our wisdom. Wisdom through endings and new vision. And for those resonating with the releasing the expectations, the closing days of August can carry a deeper message that you're not meant to hold on to what no longer serves you. Your growth, you're representing mental expansion, broadening your vision, let go of outdated beliefs. It's the endings that make space for transformation. We can be asked to lean into trusting ourselves when the old stories or the thought patterns feel like they're unraveling. You may even feel a sense of uncertainty or grief as you release what once felt secure. But this shedding is a sacred act. You are not losing. You are clearing space for new truth to take root. So during this time, you can notice where you feel tempted to cling to certainty. You can acknowledge that endings are not failures, but doorways. Remembering that wisdom does not always arrive through effort, but a lot of times through allowing. This divine timing woven into August assures you that the clarity you seek will reveal itself when the old stuff is fully surrendered. You are the bridge between the past and the future, and we're invited to walk in it with faith. Lastly, on the energy side of it, prosperity through presence and power. When we're ready to merge our inner and our outer values, this period highlights our relationship with power, with prosperity, and our self-worth. It carries the vibration of mastery, of influence, because it knows how to build, to manifest, and to lead. But under the gaze of embodying our value system, the message shifts. True power does not come from forcing the outcomes or controlling the timelines. It comes from presence, trust, and alignment. This is a powerful lesson for all of us, which often feels like the pull to measure our worth by productivity or our results. We are invited to redefine our success as being in harmony with what is. So when you relax into the truth that everything is always on time, abundance is always flowing more naturally, and opportunities appear without effort sometimes. Additional calls to practice are release the need to push for immediate results, acknowledge the abundance already surrounding you, and recognize that your magnetism grows stronger when you trust rather than when you chase. When we hold the frequency of divine timing, it becomes a beacon of prosperity, reminding us that even wealth is not about accumulation, but it's about an aligned exchange with the universe. And the harmony of release, of surrender, of resourcefulness in divine timing, together this all forms a powerful dynamic. We use our vision. We allow what no longer serves us to be released, which lets the wisdom flow in. What opens up is manifestation, strength, and abundance. We are invited into a higher octave of trust. We learn that endings are not empty. They're part of divine timing. And that prosperity does not come from urgency. It flows when we're in alignment. When we remind ourselves that the universe is not bound by the clock, our experiences can often feel delayed, even denied or uncertain that it's actually even going to happen. But together, it all creates a message for us. Timelessness is real. The soul is never late. And when we live in trust, we become witnesses to miracles. How do we live this message? Here are some ways to embody this timelessness in a practical way. It's one thing to understand the truth, but it's another thing to embody them in daily life. The number one way to anchor this timelessness into your daily activities is by having a morning affirmation of alignment. Begin your day with a simple phrase, I'm always on time. What is meant for me? Arise with grace, ease, and divine order. Repeating this daily shifts your energy from anxiety to trust. Number two, practice sacred pauses. Whenever you feel the urge to rush, push, or control, take a pause, breathe deeply, and ask yourself, what if this is already working out perfectly? Your path is unfolding exactly as it should, and you are right on time.
Welcome to the Next Level series on the price of business, Digital Network. I'm Daphne Michaels, human potential expert and ultra consciousness leadership guide. Not long ago, the word spirit rarely appeared in our daily conversations, but today that's changed. We now speak of spirit in leadership, in work, and in the meaning and purpose behind our actions. This marks a profound shift, a shift that invites us to bring our full selves into the world. For those of us who have walked the path of expanding consciousness, this is a moment of alignment. It's a call to live as spiritual beings, operating at a higher frequency and embodying the fullness of who we truly are. Now is the time. The world is ready and so are we. Let's rise to this occasion and fully step into the light of our essence. Let's be who we are completely. What does this look like in practice? It starts with presence, bringing intention and authenticity into every action, meeting each moment with awareness and compassion. In leadership, it means guiding with empathy, making choices that uplift not only ourselves, but those around us. In our work, it's about infusing tasks with meaning, recognizing the ripple effect our energy and mindset have on our teams, our communities, and the world. Let's take a moment to reflect. How can we weave a sense of purpose into our daily routines? What small shifts can we make to honor our spirit? Whether it's taking a mindful breath before a big meeting, speaking our truth with kindness, or supporting someone else's growth. This is our opportunity to create environments at work, at home, in our circles, where authenticity, compassion, and higher consciousness are not just ideas, but lived experiences. As we commit to our own transformation, we light the way for others to do the same. Together, we can redefine what it means to lead, to work, and to live with spirit at the center of it all. To learn more about how to embody your spirit in life and work, visit my website at DaphneMichaels.com.
I'm Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. I'm really excited. We've had Jim Hancock as a regular commentary provider here on the Price of Business Show for quite some time. He's incredibly savvy in the technology space. And recently, he has begun to join us to do actual interviews on a regular basis about his research and work in the technology space. He's a leading authority in this space. His website, by the way, is jlhancock.com. That's jlhancock.com. He's an author. He's an author of primarily novels, in fact, that deal a lot with issues that relate to technology and national security and a lot of these issues. During his time in the military, Jim worked away at the dark corners of the government intelligence communities. He learned two Asian languages and eventually conducted over 100 combat operations with special operations forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. And so he has a fascinating background. Love having him on the program. Love doing this work with him. And again, you can learn more about him at jlhancock.com. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. Always before my chance with J.L. Hancock. He's an author extraordinaire with phenomenal background with the military, with technology, with military intelligence, and he brings this experience to every single interview he does. He's also an author, phenomenal author. I tell you, his books read like nonfiction, even though they are fiction because they're so steeped with reality in his years of experience. JL, always glad to have you on the program. A little bit about your book before we get started, and the best website for people to get more information.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here. Name is JL Hancock, and my website is pretty easy. It's just jlhancock.com, where you can find out about my books. The Voodoo series is what the books are a part of. They're The Hawk Enigma and The Spear and the Sentinel, where I discuss modern technology and artificial intelligence and a lot of the different ways in which modern technology is being employed in ways that probably people haven't considered.
Yep, very good. People should check that out. And we got a great topic today. I tell you, JL pulls from the headlines, which is really nice. Stories that are being seen, or even better, stories that aren't much talked about, but he's on top of. I think we have a little bit of both in today's topic today. We're going to talk about manned-unmanned teaming concept that's being used in the military, which sounds kind of oxymoronic, which isn't unusual for government, is it?
Yeah, par for the course.
Yeah, set the stage for us on this.
Sure. So one of the big things that's trying to be pushed with the sixth generation fighters, which is everything beyond the F-35 and the F-22, is the ability to have collaborative teaming with unmanned systems. So think of, instead of it being a pilot flying a plane, it is a pilot flying his own having his own wingman, and at the point of building out to the point where you have, instead of the one pilot, you have an entire squadron of aircraft that can be coordinated and run by one individual. However, that particular concept is extremely complex, and there's a lot of things that need to go into understanding what that actually means. And it sounds, and by concept, it may sound like it's relatively easy, but there's a lot of difficulty associated with it, and it's something that I think that a lot of people should know about.
Yeah, I don't know. When I look at my video game history, and I was only controlling one plane, I had my hands full. So
yeah.
So this sounds really complex to me.
Yeah, that's probably fair. I think I think of other old games that I used to play where the little drones that you would get would fly on the side of you, and they were pretty dumb. They either just followed your basic action, or there was nothing really complex that extended your ability when you had these things. And I think that tends to be one way that people think of it. But one of the things that is unique about unmanned teaming is the ability to take these unmanned systems and put them in areas in which you don't want to put a person. And what that means is, in combat in the air in particular, it's all about range. The thing that makes the F-35 and the 22 so dangerous when it comes to stealth isn't always just the fact that they're hard to detect. It's the fact that they can strike their enemy from much farther away. And the ability to integrate these unmanned systems allows, in one respect, for that range to increase, for the sensing to happen at a greater distance, but also for, in some cases, for those sensing elements to also strike on your behalf at a greater distance. And so you're able to reach out in ways that you couldn't before. But the complexity within these spaces is, how do you, one, build in the appropriate sensors on these systems, and then build in an autopilot that allows the systems to make decisions relative to what they're sensing? Now, that sounds weird, but this is a really easy way that I describe this to people is, imagine you're building a robot dog, and you build its legs, and you build its brain, and it can do all the things a dog can do. But when you finish it, you realize the whole reason why you might want to build a robot dog is for the things that make a robot dog or a dog a dog, and that's its nose. You forgot to build its nose into the robot because you were too busy focusing on making sure it can walk around. Well, when we build a lot of these robots, we kind of have the same problem. They build them for the ability for it to fly or to walk or to do what it does, and then they just throw a sensor on later. What they're discovering with a lot of these integrations is you have to start with the sensor, and you build around the sensor. So you build the dog around its nose. All of the things in a dog's life happen because of its nose. And so when you have an unmanned system, it's the radar, it's the radio detection at range, it's the camera, it's whatever part of the electromagnetic spectrum that you need to be detecting that is integrated into how the system behaves and why it behaves that way. And this is the complexity of the entire conversation, because that basically allows the pilot to suddenly have all these extra sensors that they don't have just their eyes, nose, and ears. They have 6th, 7th, 8th senses going beyond them that allows them to see the environment in a way they couldn't see it before, and then to act faster, and not just at human speed, but at the speed of the sensor that's detecting it.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, and people, you know, a lot of people might say, well, I mean, you know, what requires this type of, unmanned action? Of course, a lot of people think in sci-fi terms as well, but reality is, first of all flight is potentially dangerous. All military flight is potentially more dangerous. And then there's literally, you know, we see them almost as cliches in movies where, you know, this is essentially a suicide mission. And we think that's just the cliche in movies. But the reality is those have had to happen as well, that, you know, that your probability of survival is actually very low. That was particularly common in World War II with particular missions they went on. So there's a real legitimate need for what we're talking about. The nuance is getting it figured out.
Yeah, and it's, and I think that the thing that people don't understand is then the crawl, walk, run element of how you integrate these things. We're not going to default to allowing a system to operate on the edge completely on its own to do everything. It's going to be based around bespoke, isolated requirements and needs that they have rather than an all-encompassing multi-agent system. What I mean by that is there was a movie that came out a few years back where they built this drone that could make all of its own decisions on the edge, and then it decides on its own it wants to go nuke North Korea. Like, there's so many layers to what, in order for something to even come close to even having the ability to do something like that, that it's not even worth considering, because it's not like a large language model, because that's all based on, like, GPT or whatever. There's elements in there, but what people don't understand is how disconnected and disparate the systems are inside of the military by design. They aren't already connected like we are in our day-to-day world. And so there's so many things that have to be connected. So you start small. You start with saying this thing needs to be able to sense at this one range, and that's all it does. And so you have these little, instead of a Swiss Army knife, you have a scalpel, and everything is a different type of scalpel. And then you integrate all the scalpels into your kit, and then you can be a surgeon, right? But the surgeon isn't the robot. The robot is still the scalpel, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes perfect sense. So what are you going to be watching about this going forward? And what are some final thoughts you want to give to the listener about this?
The big thing to look for in this is you're going to have, from the defense standpoint, the thing that I'm interested in is the front runners are a mixture of primes, which are the traditional larger defense contractors like Raytheon or Lockheed Martin. And then there's these venture capital backed private companies that are coming up that are pushing in this space, like Anduril and Shield AI, which are really running the unmanned systems capabilities. And to watch is to see how they are down selected, and then the timelines, and then the cost for these things is they're looking at $1.6 trillion right now for these kinds of programs. And
wow.
I believe it's 1.6. It's way up there. And it's understandable because cost of R&D increases dramatically when you get into these more complex systems. But it's seeing who they down select, especially in light of the new government's approach, the current administration's approach to contracting. They're trying to be significantly more aggressive, a lot less regulation, which is intended to move faster, but it really comes down to who's down selected, how fast they intend to move, and what they actually want it to do are the things to watch out for.
Yeah, very interesting. Give that website one more time for people to get more information. Do want to remind a listener, we'll also have that at priceofbusiness.com. But go ahead and get that one more time.
Yeah, the website is JLHancock, HANCOCK.com. And once again, my name is JL Hancock.
Yeah, and what will they find there? Obviously information about your book, but you've got more than that there. I know because I've explored it. It's a very good website.
Yeah, so I also have blog posts about different parts, things I've written in books, a little tongue-in-cheek, but it also has a lot of technical references to whatever I'm discussing, and also links to other media that I've been a part of, my website with Price of Business, where you can find all the other interviews that I've done, and then a way to contact me, of course.
I encourage people to do that, too. Thanks so much, JL. I am Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. Stay tuned for more. After this. That wraps up another Price of Business. I am glad to be with you. Really enjoyed it and enjoying our new home here on these stations around the country. I do want to remind you that the show continues 24/7. Not only do we have this weekly show that you can hear on this station, but we're on other stations around the country with a daily program as well. You can easily learn about them by visiting us at priceofbusiness.com. We affectionately say, it is the show that never ends. And what we mean by that is that it continues 24/7 with the addition of new audio, video, articles, and more at priceofbusiness.com. While there, we'd like you to engage with us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Kevin Price Live and all of our sister sites as well. All right, going to take a break until next time. Next week, we'll be back with you with much more information for you. And look forward to that conversation. And I want to say, again, thank you to USA Business Radio to make it possible for this to have been commercial-free, an entire hour of commercial-free. And guess what? Even more commercial-free than public radio. So we're excited about that. Enjoy the rest of your day right here on this station.